Today is Monday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi criticized U.S. President Donald Trump on ABC's This Week following reports Russians were paying bounties on U.S. troops in Afghanistan.
This is as bad as it gets, and yet the president will not confront the Russians.
Plus, the novel coronavirus pandemic crosses the 10 million threshold.
North America, Latin America, and Europe each account for around 25% of cases.
And we continue our look ahead at the G5 Sahel Summit. We'll have those stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump denies he was briefed on U.S. intelligence reports that a Russian military intelligence unit offered bounties to Taliban-linked militants for killing American troops in Afghanistan. AP correspondent Ben Thomas starts us off.
The New York Times is reporting American intelligence officials concluded months ago that Russian officials offered rewards for successful attacks on American service members last year. At the time, the U.S. and Taliban were holding talks to end the war in Afghanistan. In a Sunday morning tweet, Trump writes, "Nobody briefed or told me, or Vice President Pence, or his chief of staff, Mark Meadows." Presumptive Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden calls the report a truly shocking revelation, if accurate. Russia calls it nonsense. Ben Thomas, Washington.
U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi spoke to ABC's This Week news program about the report.
"This is as bad as it gets, and yet the president will not confront the Russians on this score, denies being briefed. Whether he is or not, his administration knows."
To get more reaction from Capitol Hill on this developing story, I spoke to VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson.
"Well, I would say that this is one of those rare instances where you're seeing concern on both sides of the aisle. We're, of course, hearing from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who has always said that with President Trump, all roads lead back to Vladimir Putin. She has once again implied that the Russian president has some sort of background information on President Trump that is pushing him to act this way. Of course, she doesn't have any evidence of that. That's always been her supposition. And then, of course, on the Republican side, we are seeing some concerns. You know, Trump's ally, Lindsey Graham, who was golfing with the president Sunday as this report was breaking, has said that he is very concerned about this issue and wants to see Congress take a look at it. We're also, of course, hearing from former Democratic presidential candidate Kirsten Gillibrand, who has also said that. So if you're hearing calls from both sides for a congressional investigation, you can bet that that's almost certainly going to happen.
Now, the president has said and tweeted that, you know, he was not made aware of the intelligence that was coming in. And even the director of national intelligence said that, you know, there's a danger between, you know, taking report information that is raw intelligence versus that has been refined. So what is the White House doing at this point to respond to the allegations in the report?
Absolutely. That is a very key difference, to take a look at the difference between raw intelligence and what exactly was in a White House briefing. And I would also add that top congressional leaders also receive those intelligence briefings. And Nancy Pelosi said Sunday that she had not been briefed on that issue. So that's something that we'll really need to get to the bottom of here in Washington. And one way that the Trump administration is reacting to this is to brief Congress on this Monday, so that they can start to get a sense of who knew what and when.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Iran has issued an arrest warrant and asked Interpol for help in detaining U.S. President Donald Trump and dozens of others it believes carried out the drone strike that killed a top Iranian general in Baghdad. While Trump faces no danger of arrest, the charges underscore the heightened tensions between Iran and the United States since Trump withdrew America from Tehran's nuclear deal with world powers. U.S. protests over racism show no signs of slowing down. VOA's Ayan Bior looks at what is sustaining these demonstrations, along with additional reporting by Isha Sarai.
Advocates for racial justice say that the protests seen across the United States in the past month are not new, organic, or solely because of George Floyd's death. The movement has been built on years of organizing and a growing list of individuals killed at the hands of police. Cornell W. Brooks is the former president of the civil rights group NAACP.
It arrives at a moment in which the public's patience for police misconduct has been expended. So the George Floyd video arrives after the video of Philando Castile in Minneapolis, after the video of Jamar Clark in Minneapolis, but also after the video of Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Laquan McDonald.
Some demonstrators have noted how the COVID-19 pandemic has contributed to the sustained motivation of nationwide protest. Hilda Johnson is a protester in Washington, D.C.
Like, I already have to fight systemic racism. I have to fight, like, a virus that I do not understand, that no one understands. And you're still killing me on national TV? Like, just something's got to give.
This year, social media, fundraisers, and petitions have accompanied rallies in the streets.
You have the highest unemployment rate you've ever seen before. People actually have the time right now to go out into the streets. Now you realize that you and your friends can, you know, create a petition, can sign something, can, you know, get folks out on the street, can volunteer to bring water.
Black Americans who have taken to the streets in recent weeks note that discrimination and violence against them is nothing new. Like this protester who gave her first name as Sonia.
I live it, right? Because I was born a black woman, right? So this is not something that I'm just coming to realize.
Activists note that an increase of organizing and educating on social media has contributed to wider awareness of the movement. Former NAACP President Brooks.
Young people crafting hashtags, crafting messages, engaged in serial strategic disruption of daily life, globalizing the message, tying it to a set of public policy reforms, and pushing the conversation, changing the civic vocabulary.
While specific circumstances of the 2020 protest for the Black Lives Matter movement are different than previous ones, Brooks believes the current movement is the result of years of organizing.
Based on my 25 years of doing this work around the country, this is a serious moment at the dawn of a movement. I thought so 5 years ago. I don't think I was wrong.
Brooks and grassroots activists are confident this current movement will affect real change, noting it has already sparked conversation about police reform in both the local and federal governments. Ayan Bior with reporting from Aisha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
In the southern U.S. state of Mississippi, legislators have voted to remove the controversial Confederate emblem from its state flag. The AP's Julie Walker has that story.
Republican Governor Tate Reeves says he'll sign the bill. The change comes as widespread protests over racial injustice focused attention yet again on the flag. Mississippi has a 38% black population. It's the last state with a flag that includes the Confederate symbol that many people see as racist. There have been other efforts to change the flag, and many towns and colleges have stopped flying it. This time, a coalition including businesses and sports figures pushed for the change. I'm Julie Walker.
In the latest move to change place names in light of U.S. racial history, the leaders of Orange County's Democratic Party are pushing to drop film legend John Wayne's name, statue, and other likenesses from the county's airport. The Los Angeles Times reported that earlier this week, officials passed an emergency resolution condemning Wayne's racist and bigoted statements made during a 1971 interview. The resolution asked that the board restore the airport to its original name, Orange County Airport. And coming up later,
they're going to want to know, okay, these people that we put in place for the International Coalition from civil society, how is it getting on? What are they doing about grievances among population? What more can we do to try and bring not just the military solution to the Sahel, but also to make sure that there are enough actors within the civil society to get that on track?
This is VOA News.
In a minute.
A team of scientists led by Germany's University of Göttingen report they've discovered two super-Earths orbiting a red dwarf star only 11 light-years away. A super Earth has a mass greater than Earth, but much less than the ice giants Uranus and Neptune. The scientists, writing of their discovery in the journal Science, suggest that the planets Gliese 887b and Gliese 887c are located within their star's habitable zone where water can exist in liquid form. Since it's a red dwarf, dimmer and smaller than our sun, its habitable zone is much closer to the star. According to the study, Gliese 887b and 887c orbit their star every 9.3 and 21.8 days, respectively. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Over the weekend, the total number of COVID-19 cases globally surpassed 10 million. Reuters' David Doyle has more.
Global cases of coronavirus exceeded 10 million on Sunday, according to a Reuters tally, as the number of deaths from the respiratory illness approached 500,000. The grim milestone comes as many hard-hit countries ease their lockdown measures while making extensive alterations to the ways people live and work. North America, Latin America, and Europe each account for around 25% of cases, while Asia and the Middle East have around 11% and 9% respectively. That's according to a Reuters tally which uses government reports. Just two countries account for over a third of all new cases over the past week, India and Brazil. They're both battling outbreaks of over 10,000 cases a day, and Brazil reported a record 54,700 new cases on June the 19th. Some researchers say the death toll in Latin America could rise over 380,000 by October. As of Sunday morning, there had been more than 497,000 fatalities linked to COVID-19 worldwide. Some countries are also experiencing a resurgence in infections, leading authorities to partially reinstate lockdown measures in what experts say could be a recurring pattern in the coming months and into 2021. That's true in the United States, which saw cases pass the 2.5 million mark on Saturday. Several states at the center of a new surge in infections have taken steps back from efforts to ease restrictions on businesses. Countries including China, New Zealand, and Australia have also seen new outbreaks in the past month, despite largely quashing local transmission.
David Doyle reports for Reuters News. India reported close to 20,000 fresh novel coronavirus cases for the second day running on Monday, as the financial hub of Mumbai extended its lockdown by a month. India lags only behind the United States, Brazil, and Russia in the total number of cases. Shares have also fallen in Asia as rising virus cases caused some U.S. states to backtrack on pandemic reopenings. Tokyo's Nikkei index lost 2.3% Monday, and benchmarks also fell in Hong Kong, Sydney, Shanghai, and South Korea. Investors have been banking on businesses continuing to reopen, helping to drive a recovery from the worst global downturn since the 1930s Great Depression. The U.S. markets were up slightly in early Monday trading. With the European Union's external borders due to reopen July 1st, Greece is eager to see a large number of international travelers trickling into the country. Preparations, including a rash of new health regulations to shield against COVID-19 infections, are underway at thousands of tourism-related businesses. But the forecasts are grim. And worse yet, the crisis is already starting to exact cruel tolls. Anthe Karasava has that story.
When a 9-year-old girl, the daughter of an unemployed hotel chambermaid, fainted from hunger at a bakery shop on the island of Rhodes this week, shockwaves were felt across the country. Several media outlets broke into scheduled programming to report the incident. While leading government ministers were left glued to their television sets, gripped by the harrowing tale. Thanasis Stamoulis, president of the Association of Hotel Employees in Rhodes, explains. The young girl was in line, he says, waiting to get some bread, but she collapsed from starvation. This, unfortunately, is the grim reality here on the island of Rhodes, Stamoulis says. But it is just a small example of the human toll this crisis is exacting on society. With its breathtaking vistas, sandy beaches, and spectacular medieval architecture, Rhodes has long been a top vacation destination. Last year alone, the island attracted more than 2 million British, German, and American tourists. But today, weeks into Greece's tourism relaunch, not a single hotel has managed to reopen, inflicting huge losses and devastating despair across the local community, according to Stamoulis. The scenes that are unraveling here are like we are emerging from a war, he says. Every day people gather at a main square, selling their personal possessions to make some money. Rhodes is dead. Almost all shops are closed. There is just no business at all. Everything is dead. For a country heavily reliant on tourism, such scenes of despair could spell another recession for Greece, just years after it managed to steer out of an exhausting 10-year financial crisis. In a recent report, the country's central bank said travel revenue was down by 99% in April, and this after travel to Greece had dropped by more than 50% between January and March the previous year. The government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis says it is confident that some losses can be recovered with the reopening of travel. But even Yannis Retsos, the head of Greece's Tourism Confederation, the umbrella agency guiding the country's top industry, is pessimistic. At this point, he said, I'll be surprised if tourism revenues exceed 4 to 5 billion euros. That's just a fraction of the nearly 18 billion euros the country raked in from tourism last year, providing jobs to 1 in 5 workers here. From the start of the pandemic, the government injected more than 10 billion euros into the economy to keep businesses operating mainly in the tourism trade. But that appears to be too little. Finance Minister Christos Staikouras recently announced that the government expected the country to suffer a contraction of 8% of gross domestic product in 2020, with a whopping 16% down in the second quarter of the year. Greece had originally expected its economy to grow by nearly 3% this year, and workers like the now unemployed chambermaid in Rhodes had hoped for better rather than tougher times. Antti Karasava for VOA News, Athens, Greece.
Gunmen attacked the Pakistan Stock Exchange building in the city of Karachi Monday, killing 2 guards and a policeman before security forces killed all 4 of the attackers. Separatist insurgents from Balochistan province claimed responsibility in a post on Twitter, but Reuters News was not able to verify the authenticity of the claim, and spokesmen for the group were not available for comment. An official said 2 guards and a policeman were killed and 7 people were wounded. A state-orchestrated campaign is slashing births among the minority Uyghurs of China's far west Xinjiang region. The Associated Press says in an investigative report that the government is forcing IUDs, abortions, and sterilizations on largely Muslim minorities and detains parents who violate family planning measures. As a result, birth rates in the heavily Uyghur regions have plunged over 60% in just 3 years. Authorities say they're trying to cut down on poverty and extremism, but outside experts call it an extraordinary experiment in state-led eugenics aimed at forcibly assimilating Muslim minorities. China's foreign ministry called the story fabricated and fake news, saying the government treats all ethnicities equally and protects the legal rights of minorities. The United Nations top human rights official, Michelle Bachelet, called on Israel Monday to halt its illegal plans to annex part of occupied Palestinian territory in the West Bank and warned it could lead to deadly clashes. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's plan to extend Israeli sovereignty over Jewish settlements in the territory has drawn condemnation from the Palestinians, U.S. Arab allies, and other foreign governments. His cabinet is due to begin formal annexation deliberations on Wednesday, July 1st. Tomorrow, French President Emmanuel Macron will be attending the G5 Sahel Summit. It's the first of 2 meetings that the French leader will be participating in. Following the G5 meeting, participants will be expanded as well as the topics. Catherine Field is in Paris, and I spoke with her via WhatsApp to get a preview.
After the summit, it is going to widen out, and you're going to have a video conference with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel. You're going to have the European Council President. You're going to have the Italian and the Spanish Prime Ministers. So we're seeing there France pushing to have a more of a multilateral approach to the Sahel and get all these actors involved. That having been said, there is still, and there will always be, the allegation there that because of France's strong bilateral ties, they're using this whole G5 Sahel to promote France's own interests in the region. So there's going to be a lot to talk about, and you know, they're going to get down. It's only a very short meeting, but Emmanuel Macron, the French president, feels he has to go out there. He's doing a day trip, but he's got to be present.
Now, that's one aspect of the meetings that are going to take place. What else are they looking to achieve during the summit?
Well, if you remember back again, January in that summit here in France, the G5 agreed on this international coalition for the Sahel. Now, this is a sort of a getting civil society involved. It's not just getting civil society involved. It's also, if you like, an acceptance that it's not just a military response to what is happening in the Sahel. There are these aspects such as weak government accountability, weak governance, poor, or if you like, weak private sector economy, all these other issues that make for a difficult pathway forward for political stability. So they're going to want to know, okay, these people that we put in place for the international coalition from civil society, how is it getting on? What are they doing about grievances among population? What more can we do to try and bring not just the military solution to the Sahel, but also to make sure that there are enough actors within the civil society to get that on track?
With Emmanuel Macron going to Africa for the Sahel G5 summit, is China going to come up at all?
It will come up indeed, and that could be one of the criticisms that you will hear when Emmanuel Macron is there and when they widen the summit out to include Angela Merkel and the Italian Prime Minister and the Spanish Prime Minister, is that the Chinese aren't involved. Now, when you look at China, particularly what China is involved in Chad, Niger, you're looking at them being involved in infrastructure, energy, and also other investments in oil, gas, uranium. So you could say, well, you know, they should be at the table. They should be having some sort of input. The fact that they're not, they haven't been invited, certainly does lead one to think that, yes, you know, the European Union is realizing that it's got to get that profile back, if you like, on the African continent, particularly in areas where the Chinese are increasingly prominent, not just in those big infrastructure, but also railways, bridges, roads, that the Europeans, that used to be their thing, if you like.
Catherine Field is a reporter based in Paris, France. At least 23 civilians were killed in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province, and dozens were wounded when rockets hit a cattle market on Monday. The Afghan and Taliban officials blamed one another for the attack on the open-air weekly cattle market in Sangjin district, where hundreds of villagers from neighboring districts had gathered to trade sheep and goats. The Rolling Stones' 1969 classic, You Can't Always Get What You Want, has been a popular song at U.S. President Donald Trump's events, but the members of the legendary rock group aren't happy. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has the details.
You Can't Always Get What You Want was played again at the close of Trump's recent rally in Tulsa, an indoor event criticized for its potential to spread coronavirus. Other artists have also complained about having their music associated with the rallies. The family of the late Tom Petty says it had issued a cease and desist order after Trump used the song I Won't Back Down in Tulsa. A statement says both the late Tom Petty and his family firmly stand against racism and discrimination of any kind. Tom Petty liked to bring people together. Charles de Ledesma, London.
You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.